Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, in just a moment, we'll have an update on the severe weather that southern states, including Georgia, have been experiencing the last 2 days, and now flooding in the region. Also, Governor Brian Kemp has signed Senate Bill 140, which bans most medical and hormone treatments for transgender youth to affirm their gender identity. So I'll speak with faith leaders regarding how they plan to help families affected by the law. And later in the program, an Atlanta family shares their story. That's all ahead, but we'll begin with the weather. Governor Kemp has issued a state of emergency after intense storms tore apart structures in Troup County and surrounding areas. Sam Marlowe is a forecaster with the National Weather Service in Peachtree City.
So as of right now, we are still currently working on sending people out for surveys. So we don't have much information. The only thing that we have at the moment is we do know that there was a tornado in Troup County.
Officials say 5 people were reportedly injured and the storm trapped some in their homes. The severe weather was powerful enough to break open a tiger enclosure at the Pine Mountain Animal Safari. A Troup County spokesperson said an escaped tiger was later captured, however, 2 hours later. The governor's declaration frees up state resources and rescue vehicles to respond to damaged and flooded areas. Meanwhile, the Red Cross has opened shelters in Troup and Baldwin counties for storm victims. The severe weather also left heavy amounts of rainwater in Atlanta and surrounding areas, plus some reports of hail. Forecaster Sam Marlowe says flooding is always a potential danger after heavy rains.
So we are still monitoring flooding across the area. There are a few creeks that are currently in flood stage. So if you're nearby one of those, just continue to monitor that. Our current flash flooding risk is more towards the south of the metro area and close towards Macon as well.
Now, some folks are being evacuated from homes near the Heads Creek Reservoir in Spalding County. There, officials say water levels are rising after the area received 7 inches of rain and surrounding roads are being closed. In other news, Georgia Supreme Court is set to hear oral arguments this week in a lawsuit over the state's abortion law. The law bans abortions after about 6 weeks of pregnancy, as we hear from Jess Mador.
Judges are hearing an appeal by the state to a previous Fulton County Superior Court's block on the abortion law, HB 481. It took effect last year and bans abortion after fetal cardiac activity is detected in the womb. Attorneys representing abortion rights groups and physicians say the law is unenforceable because HB 481 passed in 2019 when Roe v. Wade was still in effect. But last summer, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe, and the state attorney general is arguing Georgia's ban is valid and should remain in effect. Now it's up to the state Supreme Court to decide. After arguments on Tuesday, a ruling could still take months. Jess Mador, WABE News.
Georgia's legislative session is in its final days. Some big measures that haven't passed yet include a bill to help add mental health providers in the state, an attempt to legalize some forms of sports betting, creating a board to oversee local prosecutors, and the state budget. They've got to work through all that. The last day of the session is this Wednesday, the day known as Sine Die, when lawmakers typically vote on bills long into the night to finish their business for the year. And speaking of Georgia lawmakers, did you know they earn just over $22,000 a year? Well, the idea behind their relatively low salary is, well, it's a citizens' legislature made up of people with other jobs. But as Jasmine Robinson reports, some argue that level of pay is a barrier to entry.
Georgia state lawmakers got a slight pay bump this year, part of a cost of living increase for all state employees. This was their first raise in 16 years. Republican Representative Barry Fleming of Harlem opposes any more increases. He says he doesn't want people to run for office for the money.
You don't want someone to be doing this because it's their full-time job. You want the person here to be a full-time citizen and to go back and live under the laws that we pass.
But there are state lawmakers who argue with the pay as it is. Many Georgians can't afford to step away from their lives and jobs for 40 days a year. Democratic Representative Sam Park of Lawrenceville says a pay bump could diversify the legislative body.
The relatively low pay and the time commitment required for the legislature, it certainly prevents a lot of working class Georgians from really having an opportunity to have a seat at the table, which is so important.
Last year, there was a bill to raise lawmaker pay that passed the House but died in the Senate. This session, it didn't come up. Jasmine Robinson, WABE News.
Some healthcare advocates in Georgia say they're concerned more than 500,000 residents could lose their health insurance. That's as the COVID-19 public health emergency is set to expire, and the Medicaid continuous coverage requirements start to unwind April 1st. Paige Havens with the Gwinnett Coalition says its goal is to raise awareness about the changes that could or will affect people's insurance status and access to some COVID-related resources.
So again, that's why we're looking at saying, how can we rally around those clinics who serve our un- and uninsured? How can we educate people about where those resources are? So our goal really will be to continue strongly messaging around where are the resources.
Haven says people enrolled in Medicaid and Peach Care for Kids will be asked to reapply, and the process of redetermining eligibility could take 12 to 18 months. Providers are said to be reaching out to people who need to reapply. Havens added, if they do so, it's important now to respond in a timely manner to avoid a gap in health coverage. And finally, welcome back, Morehouse Relays. After 9 years and multi-million dollar renovations, Morehouse College hosted their signature track and field event this past weekend. According to the college, there were over 1,800 participants, which included 18 universities and colleges for men's and women's teams, along with 12 middle schools. Morehouse's track and field team would finish first in the relays, Tennessee State second, and the Maroon Tigers would also place in 23 events and finished in the top five in some. I know Olympic great and Morehouse alum Edwin Moses was all smiles. Congratulations, Morehouse. You're listening to Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Georgia Senate Bill 140, signed into law by Governor Brian Kemp last week, was among hundreds of legislations. In fact, more than 400 proposals in legislatures nationwide that were cited by the ACLU as targeting the rights and quality of life for those in the LGBTQI community. Senate Bill 140, as we have been talking about, prevents minors from accessing some surgeries and hormone therapies necessary as part of one's gender-affirming care. Kemp, via social media statement, said in part, quote, "It's an important step in protecting the health and well-being of Georgia's children," close quote. Faith leaders are often called upon to counsel transgender youth and their families. But now what? Joining me now is the Reverend Leo Sage Allen. He's a Baptist minister and the Georgia campaigns manager for Faith and Public Life. Say that four times. Also, Rebecca Staple Wax, the executive director of Sojourn, the Southern Jewish Resource Network for Gender and Sexual Diversity. Thank you both for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with learning a little bit more about your respective organizations. And Rebecca, I'll start with you. Tell our listeners a little bit more about Sojourn.
Sojourn has been around since 2013, but been doing the work in the Jewish community since 2001. Our mission is to empower communities to advance and celebrate gender and sexual diversity across the South.
Reverend Allen?
Yes. So thank you again, Rose. And Faith in Public Life and Faith in Public Life Action Fund are organizations, C3 and C4, with a network of clergy across the country. We are a multi-faith coalition representing what we feel is the majority voice that is not often heard in the halls of power.
You mentioned the halls of power. What's been your response or the conversation you've had with people? They talk about this intersection of faith and sexuality and identity. What kind of conversations are you having? Reverend Allen, I'll let you start.
Most often, I guess. Yeah, so this is it's so personal for me. You know, I'm an out transgender Baptist minister. Do not run across people like me often, but I'm having conversations with folks in my own Baptist church as well as rabbis and imams who are coming to me, frankly, in tears, wondering, you know, where do we go from here? There are trans and queer children and whole families in their congregations. And what we've been talking about is what's the next faithful step? And the key right now that we see in providing spiritual care is to be there for trans children and teenagers who are afraid of what this means, to stand in solidarity with all faiths, to echo what we know is the truth, which is that the majority of Georgians, including 56% of Republicans, were against this bill and did not want to see any further harm done to trans children, particularly in something so critical and necessary in a state like Georgia when it comes to health care.
Director Staple Wax, what are those conversations like for you?
A lot of them are about education and really getting to understand the fluidity of gender, and that in our tradition, people have always been here, and that if we learn a lot more about our diversity, then we can open our minds and we can be much more compassionate and able to support our families and our congregants.
I received an email from a listener who said they supported the law because they felt like perhaps children needed more time and needed to become till they were 18. And we've heard that before, to make a decision. Director, I'll stay with you for a moment. And then, because I want you to follow, I want you to respond to this. The listener then went on to say, God doesn't make mistakes, Rose. And that's a quote from the listener. I imagine you've heard that.
Many times. And there's a term in Hebrew, Betzalel Elohim. We're all made in the divine image. And so if God doesn't make mistakes, then when there's a variety of ways in which to present and identify and be, then there's all ways in which to be a person. And when I hear more time, if these folks would know families that have had very young children who know their identity very young, I think that they would have a very different impression of what it's like to be transgender.
Reverend Allen, I want you to respond to that, what I got, that email from that listener.
Yeah, that is such a common refrain that I actually heard in my own household growing up. Mm-hmm. And And my parents have since come such a long way in terms of being inclusive and affirming. And it goes back to what my Jewish friend just mentioned, which is the education piece of it. You know, as a Christian, as a follower of Jesus, I know that God does not make mistakes. And I see the beauty and the diversity of creation of all kinds, all different genders, all different species. And I wonder, why in the world would that be any different for human beings, you know? And so I do not believe, as we believe at Faith and Public Life, our coalition, we do not believe that God makes mistakes, but that there is inherent dignity and worth in every human being that is made in the divine image. I think that what is most disheartening about this bill is that we are now criminalizing families, we are criminalizing doctors, and taking away that sacred dignity, taking away their God-given right to be and to flourish in the authenticity of who they are.
So, and here's a question for both of you, and I'll stay with you, Reverend Allen. As faith leaders who counsel families and young folks, are you going to have to change anything about that process? And I imagine, maybe I'm wrong, you've had families already reach out to you now that this has been signed into law.
Yeah, that kind of influx of dialogue has certainly picked up in the last few days. But I don't think that there's anything different that people of faith who believe that decisions about our bodies should be made between us and our families and our God and medical providers. I don't think there's anything different that folks need to do per se, but I do think that we need to be more intentional about speaking up and speaking out. You know, this is not an issue. These are people's lives we're talking about. We're talking about, you know, LGBTQ teens who 55%, the Trevor Project reported, who hear religion weaponized against their gender and sexual orientation have contemplated suicide. So I think the intentionality about speaking up, you know, in our synagogues, in our mosques, in our pulpits, speaking up and speaking out and saying, we know that you are beloved by God. There's no law that can strip you of that right. And we are going to do everything that we can to support you in flourishing in a way that best aligns with who God's called you to be.
Director Staplewax, is that the same for you all in terms of how you will continue to counsel families and youth?
And we definitely support directly to the families and youth. One of the areas in which I think we really need to support is the clergy, and that they are feeling supported in their pastoral care, that they realize the gravity of these laws. And I think until the governor signed the law, did many people feel like this was an aberration and this won't happen here, where now it is going to be challenged. But the changes are in that it's intensified, and that families and those that surround them need more and more support.
And Director, you are a licensed professional counselor, a national certified counselor, and I know that you have an interest, if you worked in terms of suicide prevention. You've trained, from what I could read, thousands of youth, educators, parents, clergy, and advocates. Take our listeners through what that training is like. What's that process? And how different it is from training someone to deal just in a general suicide prevention path.
So one of the trainings we use is sources of strength, and it's really finding the areas in which our lives are strong and that we can rely on. And many times it's in spiritual communities. And so we provide information that makes people feel more confident. I think a lot of times in religious communities, people don't feel like they're equipped. They don't have the language. They don't have the texts to rely on. In Jewish tradition, there are many texts in oral commentaries. There's a variety of identities that are specified hundreds of times. And so when people are equipped with this knowledge, mm-hmm. and they feel like they can respond. They have tools to use, and that's what we do. We provide tools and the ability to converse about this topic.
Reverend Allen, in the work that you do and with youth, you've counseled youth who were contemplating dying by suicide, had those thoughts, or any type of other mental health concerns. Tell us just, what do you hear from some of these youth? Why?
Well, Rose, I was one of those youth.
Yeah.
And struggled with, you know, thoughts of ending my own life and attempts even. And I know the research shows that in the South, in the Southeast in particular, those numbers are rising. What I have done is to not just draw on that experience to be able to say, you know, with truth that it really does get better, but to sit with them in the grief, to sit with them in the reality that there are so many trans and queer youth who do not have families who are supportive. To sit with them there, to acknowledge the painful realities, but then to be able to myself offer up in my own personhood and in all of the many affirming and welcoming congregations that I know, to be able to offer up those resources directly.
Who sat with you during your truth?
You know, many times I had to lean on chosen family. The family, the church family I grew up in that I'm no longer affiliated with was not a safe space for me. Mm-hmm. And that is why this work that I do with Faith and Public Life Action is so, so important. Because had I seen people like me or known that there were other pastors and rabbis, et cetera, who read their text in a liberating way, in a life-giving way, not condemning my very being. Had I had that, perhaps, you know, some of those moments of just questioning my purpose and my value wouldn't have happened. And so I found that actually in faith communities that became my chosen family. I found new siblings. I found new spiritual counselors. And I found really a new passion for this kind of work, because I'm still amazed at how many people come up to me with tears or just with shock and awe on their face to know someone like me exists. And I say, oh, don't worry, there's more of us and we love you and we're here for you.
May I ask what your relationship is like with your family now?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that my family has come a long, long way, have deep roots in the Black Baptist Church, and I love and hold on to those roots. But we've had some really honest kitchen table conversations over the last 17 years, and has not always been easy. But my family uses my name, the name that affirms me. They are often actually reaching out to me now, saying, what's happening with this anti-LGBTQ stuff? Don't these politicians know better? And then, you know, we can share in those moments of just realizing how far we've come. We still have a long ways to go. You know, I have nieces and cousins who privately have conversations with me about their sexual or gender identity. And my role, I think, is just to be that beacon of hope in my own family and community. And that is what gives me strength for the journey, strength for and hope, prophetic hope, that if I change one person's mind or one person's heart because they know a trans or queer person, right? Mm-hmm. Which we all do. But if I can do that work within my own family, then I know it's possible for us to do it in our greater community.
And have those conversations also, through your lens, that include certain or a different set of optics that are different because you are a person of color as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
the family we're going to speak to next after this segment is a family of color.
Yes.
And folks, they don't understand it. There are optics of and based on different ethnicities and races and religions and cultures. It is what it is, whether folks want to accept it or not. So that's why we have these conversations. And so as a person of color, there are some different conversations that folks might throw at you in our village, in our family, in our community. I'm a person of color.
Indeed. And I like to rely on scripture where I can, and also on the songs of my Baptist upbringing that got my grandparents through. I know, as my grandma used to sing, that trouble don't last always. Right now, in many, but not all, Black religious communities, there is transphobia, there's queerphobia, but it really is the fear. And as my counterpart was saying, if we continue to speak up and speak out and open ourselves up vulnerably to have conversations, we'll recognize that at the heart of all of our traditions and what we truly believe and want is that God is love. And as we say at Faith and Public Life, love brings choice. You know, 1 Corinthians 13 says that love isn't coercive. Love doesn't boast or brag. It rejoices in the truth. And the truth is that there are Black LGBTQ people in our family holding all of these multiple identities who need to know that they are loved, that they are supported, and that they are cared for.
By the way, if you haven't heard Trouble Don't Last Always by the Mississippi Mass Choir, you're missing out. Director, I want to come back to you for a second because we focused on, you know, the Black community here. And I'm wondering, too, because you counsel Jewish families, Jewish youth. They're the same here, a set of certain optics that are just unique to this community, this culture that you deal with.
There's a wide range of traditions and rituals and customs and beliefs. And I have my own journey where I was swooped up and taken directly to the rabbi's wife, who was going to tell me I was going to be sad and lonely for the rest of my life when I was coming out. And that has, Reverend Allen, when you were speaking about the change in family, it's a beautiful thing. Their mountains can be moved. People can change. This can be, there is hope for everyone. And I love that there are families that are now supportive, and we're actually being ridiculed for supporting our kids. Whereas when there were times that families, and still do, don't support their kids. And is that the family makeup that we want? No. We want the families that are affirming their gender of their children need to be lifted up.
As we begin to wrap up, and Director, I'll stay with you for a moment. And the ACLU of Georgia says they're going to sue. And we should be very clear, too, that this Senate Bill 140 is among hundreds of legislation other general assemblies are dealing with throughout the nation. But in the meanwhile, your message to folks, to transgender youth, to families, what do you want them to know?
We are here. We are not backing down. We are absolutely going to fight this fight to the end, and that we are a safe place in Georgia. And what families can do is to find those voices and those that support. There's been thousands of people who have responded to SB 140 that have been against it, and we will remain here.
Reverend Allen, I'll give you the last word. What's your message?
Yeah, my message is that you're not alone, that we have your back. There's coalitions of hundreds of people of faith from all sorts of belief systems, all walks of life, who are here for you, who are not only going to be praying and speaking up and speaking out, but are going to actively show up in solidarity to make sure that our kids and our families are safe and that no law takes away rights that we know that God has said are ours.
The Reverend Leo Shage Allen is a Baptist minister and the Georgia Campaigns Manager for Faith and Public Life. I was also joined by Rebecca Staple Wax, the Executive Director of Sojourn, the Southern Jewish Resource Network for Gender and Sexual Diversity. Thank you both for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for bringing attention to all of this.
Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. As mentioned in our previous segment, the ACLU of Georgia plans to sue the state regarding Senate Bill 140. And again, now signed into law, it bans most medical and hormone treatments for transgender kids to affirm their gender identity. And meanwhile, for many families, there is a central question of what now. So joining me in studio, the Frame family. We have Naima, Oman, Soraya. And tell everybody your name.
I'm Ochenna.
My co-host for today. Ochenna, how old are you?
Nine.
You're not. You sure you're nine?
Yes.
Thank you all for coming in. I really appreciate the time. I'm going to start with the parents, with mom and dad. Tell the listeners about your family.
You want me to go first? Okay.
I'm glad you asked.
I'm
a starting stuff.
Yes. No, this is how we roll. I think the interesting thing about how we started with this conversation was, you know, both of us are in education, so we always think about what the kids' needs are at this at the central focus of anything that we do, especially when we were talking about having kids and a family. And I think from there, we just kind of let our kids be who they were. You know, it's like we didn't have a name for them. Naima's tradition for a while until they grew into their name. So that's a big piece of it. What do you think?
I think that centering our children has always been our primary focus in our parenting lives. And so, you know, the journey with Soraya and Ochenna has been one that, you know, where we certainly had a script written for them. We have allowed space for, you know, particularly Soraya now as the oldest, to write their own script. And, you know, that's not always an easy thing as a parent.
Take that further for our listeners who are saying, what do you mean by write their own script?
Sure. You know, I think as parents, you choose to have children or you have children and you have a vision of where you want their lives to go. And at some point, the script that you've written, you realize if you provide space that they have their own ideas. They have their own authentic selves, and your job is no longer to continue to write the script, but to step back a little bit and allow their script to evolve for who it is that is developing in front of you. And I think as parents, sometimes it's very easy for us to interfere with that journey. And so for us, with both of our children, it's been important for us to listen and to listen not only to what is said, but what is unspoken.
And both of you work in education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think another piece to it, to add on to what Naima said, was also kind of stepping back from any preconceived notions of what we knew, allowing them to be the author of their own journey. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we can think one thing, as all human beings do, but that is not as easily transferable to someone else. So listening to what they did, listening to Soraya in particular and their journey has always been our main focus, is support, understanding and making sure that they are living the best life that they can.
Do you worry about Soraya? I know.
Every day.
Oh,
and
every
most
moment.
And parents probably worry about their kids regardless.
Every
right?
moment of every day.
Yeah.
Soraya, how old are you?
I'm 15.
15. Do you remember, can you take us back to the conversation you had with your family about when you said to them, this is how I want to identify, this is who I feel I am, this is who I am? What was that conversation like?
When I came out to them as agender, I was in the car on the way to a soccer game, and it just came up while we were talking about school and who I was as a person.
Mm-hmm.
I told my dad first. I told him that I identified as agender, non-binary, and we just kept going. We went to the
soccer game.
And
yeah.
We played.
Yeah. Did you have that conversation with your friends first before your parents?
I told my friends, my really close friends, before I told my parents, to just get an idea of what it would be like to tell somebody. And I told my friends that had the same experience as me, so they also identified as non-binary or under the trans umbrella, and having somebody that felt the same way or had the same experience as I did, telling them before I told my parents was, I think, really important.
And that helped you?
Yeah, definitely.
So mom and dad, you're on your way to soccer.
I remember it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think the two things that we've been able to do as parents have been to understand that our journey, you know, being me being 51 years old, Naima being 22 years old.
Thank you.
One of the things that
he is good. I tell you, boy, you got him. I hope all say spouses are paying attention to this.
Yes.
You don't tell the age unless you've been told to.
Exactly. I think the main thing was that it was something that our main focus was to make sure that Soraya and Uchenna by proxy were happy, healthy, full human beings. And that was not even a bump in the road. It was okay, keep it moving. And it was also interesting because we had a very transitional time in our house with Naima's mother, who was living with us, passed away. And that was one of the precipices for us really to being open. And it was also one that really brought us together in this, providing a lot of insight into taking a step back, not knowing everything.
Soraya, you have a little sister who's also my co-host for today.
Yep.
How you doing down there? You're sitting next to me in a very low chair. You all right down there?
Yeah.
All right. You have anything to say about all of this?
Was I in the car with you guys?
You were not, no.
So, like, when I didn't hear about this, so I was, like, confused.
Okay.
So, please can you give me like an update? Okay. And then for the past couple of years I've been like correcting the parents and other people.
So you so
I'm
you,
the corrector.
Okay.
She corrects our pronoun usage.
Yep.
And so like I'm the person who's mostly like I get almost everything correct.
Goodness. Running a house, huh? This conversation with the house corrector here sounds like it went smoothly, but what was the conversation with other immediate family? Or do you even concern yourself with that?
I mean, I think that the easy ones are the younger generation, right? They're the ones that are open. They're leading the charge. So for Uchenna, it's been seamless, right? Like, so Uchenna went from having a sister to having a sibling with no issue.
Didn't miss a beat.
You know, for us, you know, as previously stated, you know, we just wanted space for Soraya to be. And I think it's interesting that Soraya chose to tell Oman first because they know that there's an emotional piece and connectedness that I have that's different than Oman's. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, while they know that I'm in their corner 199%, right, that there is also an emotional process that I go through. And so it's interesting. I don't even know that Soraya knows that when Soraya, began identifying as agender, mm-hmm. Oman called me prior to them coming home and gave me a heads up. It was like, okay, I just need you to know that they're going to talk to you about this. Mm-hmm. Which I really appreciated because I had to take my own self through it. There was no doubt where I would land, right? But my own emotional process of getting there. For the older generations, like grandparents, you know, like they love the kids. So, mm-hmm. you know, at the heart of it is that these are their grandchildren and this is their grandchild and they, you know, are going to accept and be open. They don't understand. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of labeling and that they don't understand, but they're on board for mm-hmm. Soraya.
Did your family receive counseling or did you talk to folks?
No, I mean, we did our own personal counseling. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, therapy is important, especially in this day and age. But one of the things that I think we have been the conduits to our parents and our families about what's been going on, letting them know, letting them also, and also being aware, making them aware that, you know, we're not taking any of the nonsense because that's our kid. We are that kind of parents. We're going to protect them at every cost.
As you all started to hear more about Senate Bill 140, Soraya, what were your thoughts?
It was scary at first. I have friends at school that are trans and that this impacts them directly. So that was scary at first. And it still is.
Yeah. Naeem?
It's emotional, you know, because it's personal, and it's personal not just through my connection with Soraya, but my connection to children in the classroom and children that I've seen go through the classroom. And, you know, children want to know how they can help, right? How can they help the decision makers see them? And that's hard. It's hard when you're talking about, you know, a conservative leaning state, and advocacy and youth advocacy and what matters.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we've just tried to have open conversation. There's no secrets in our house. You know, we try to have open conversations about the impact, not only personally, but the impact that extends beyond our family. And, you know, just conversation that it doesn't have to be your immediate your immediate issue, but that everyone's issues are mm-hmm. your issues too.
Yeah, I would say the other piece to it that you know, that attaches directly to me is, you know, I've been in the classroom for 25, almost 27 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've known kids going through this process since day one. So it's not like this is not an issue somewhere. This mm-hmm. is an issue no matter what. And no matter how many times people try to stop it, it's only going to give kind of, it's only going to create separation from who can get the services they need and who can't. But it ultimately comes down to how we see each other individually and collectively. Like, what I feel is individually important for me may not be something that I want to roll out to everyone. I mean, I like vanilla ice cream. That doesn't mean everyone who doesn't like vanilla ice cream, you know, is doing something wrong. It's like, you can't roll out with one thing.
You all are educators. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, have you all had kids come to you and confide in you before they went to their families?
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Yes, I've had several kids come through my classroom and, you know, process identity. When we do, it's a heavily identity-based class. Talk about issues of race, class, and gender.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really is a space where they, especially in middle school years where identity formation is so important, where they have come out as trans, and they've come out as trans prior to going home and processing and having that conversation and what that would look like when they went home.
And your family is the intersection of all that, race, class, and identity.
Yes. Yeah.
You are a family of color.
Yeah. Yes. And it's interesting that we've actually parlayed a lot of that into Uchenna's grade K coming through.
Mm-hmm.
So equipping kids younger with the information that they need really has given them a sense of ownership as to what identity is going to look like.
Soraya, have you had friends who have talked to you, and obviously you don't have to mention any names, who have talked to you about that this was so draining on them, that the mental burden, that perhaps they contemplated some harming themselves in any way?
I have had friends that have come to me and been like, this is extremely stressful and hard, and at times I do want to harm myself, but I listen to them and I help them through that. And by doing that, I believe that if that were to ever happen to me, they're open for me to come talk to them about it. And I think that that's something that is important in relationships with friends,
mm-hmm.
classmates, and everything. So I have had friends come to me about it, and it's scary to hear that your friend wants to hurt themselves, but getting past that and helping them it's an experience that it makes me feel good that I was able to help them.
You were able to help. And I mean, when you hear Soraya talk about that and what they experienced and how they're helping others or potentially helping others.
Yeah, I mean, it gets me emotional. It chokes me up because I, you know, listeners can't see Soraya, and I know Soraya very intimately, right? So I know Soraya's, the emotionality behind what Soraya is saying. And it's, you know, I feel very, you know, I feel like we're very blessed that we have such a supportive unit. And I, you know, I wish that everyone out there did. But I, you know, I find, I don't know, hope, maybe a sense of peace that that we as parents have provided space for Soraya to be their authentic selves that might then, you know, set the stage that allows or at least provide space for some of their friends to have an ally and a confidant in them.
And then us vicariously through us.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that Naima will downplay this, I think the one thing that we've been able to do and directly through Naima's leadership as one kind of the house captain has been to raise kids and raise children to be the best they can be. And also to come from a place of being kind, come from a place of being understanding, and come from a place of standing up for what you believe in. You know, I think we've done a great job of instilling those things at a kind of a, you know, that's a central focus in our house.
Have you had other families or other parents come to you and either ask for some guidance or
yes,
really want to talk to you about this process?
Yes. You know, that's part of our, in terms of being in education, a lot of parents, once it gets to a certain point, will want to reach out because they know the kids have either told that we are parent people they can talk to, or through Soraya, they know that people in Soraya and Uchenna, they have a resource in us as parents, and especially as, you know, Black American solidly middle class educators, it's like, it's a magnet for people to reach out.
Have you all as a family had to discuss or work through any faith intersection here? I'm curious, either with as a family or from others.
I think from others, people sometimes can linger in the background sometimes. But for us, we have a very spiritually grounded approach to things. Gosh, where do we start with this one?
I would simply say that we have a spiritual connectedness, yes, but not a denominational
connectedness. Yes, a universal connectedness.
Yeah. You know, there's a little bit of a buffer with that.
Yeah. A little bit down here. What do you want folks to know about your family? I got you. Oh, you're speechless. I didn't know I could do that. What do you want folks to know about your family and how cool you think they are?
Oh, there's a coolness level. And my whole family is at 1 million, infinity percent. They're the coolest kids in the world.
All right. Get you your own show, you know that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that, it's only tongue-tied. All of a sudden got tongue-tied.
As we begin to wrap up, and you heard the faith leaders I had on earlier, and we've talked to folks from, well, we've attempted to talk to folks from both sides. And again, for listeners who are wondering, we have reached out to every member, every state lawmaker who was behind the measure, and no one wanted to come on the program, so we just want to be fair about that. As we begin to wrap up, what is your hope for not just your family and not just for Soraya and their journey, but what do you want folks to know about life if this indeed is going to be law?
Ooh, I got a little whip of emotion there. I think for me, what I'm hoping is that people see beyond their what they think they may understand, and open the door for someone to see differently in the world and walk differently in the world. Because community is the primary resource we all can share. And no matter what your political ideology is, humanity and the humanness of where we are, we all belong here. You know, my dream is for a world that's belonging, where if you're missing, if that little piece of the puzzle, if the non-binary, trans, agender, you know, piece of the pie is missing, that it's missing and it is missed, so that we include that, because every voice has something to say.
Naima?
I just wish people would just work from a heart level and get out of their heads and just understand that humanity should take precedent, that we all you know, at the end of the day are cut from the same cloth, and that just because someone doesn't look like you or think like you or present like you, identify as you, does not diminish their value in any way.
Sarai, I'll give you the last word. What do you want folks to know about your journey?
I think my journey has been a nice one. I feel like I'm in a very safe space, and I feel like I'm able to talk about things that need to be talked about in my household, and I find that very, very exciting and happy. I'm happy that I'm able to do that.
Saraya, Naima, Oman, a little bit also known as Ochina, did I say that right? Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.